from ACB Radio Mainstream. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
I'd like to begin by thanking our producer on Tuesday Topics, Brian Charlson, and our recorder and editor, Mr. Steve Bauer from Kansas, without whom this program would be in big trouble. And obviously, I'd like to thank George Bies and Talking Communities for devising and making available the software that we're using to record this community radio program. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're fortunate to have with us someone who I've had the privilege of knowing for about 10 or 15 years. And we've had him on Tuesday Topics once before to talk about access technology, but that's not what he's going to talk about tonight. There are probably few people in the access technology field who are more respected than Noel Runyon, but I don't know them. For the most part, Noel is perceived as a person who has been there from the beginning and has been involved in virtually all facets of the access technology field. And that means that he actually brings a pretty broad range of skills to the specific issue that he is concerned with now. And that issue is voting machines. Before we actually get into voting machines, Mr. Noel Runyon, first, welcome to the program, and second, why don't you tell us a little about your background as an engineer, and perhaps what in the world possessed you to become involved with the whole issue of voting machines?
Well, good evening, and thank you for having me on, Paul. And I'm glad you gave me a chance to explain who I really am, because people may not realize who I am after your introduction there. But I am an electrical engineer and computer scientist. I live out in California in the Santa Clara Valley, where I originally went to work for IBM. Worked there for about 5 years. Ended up doing a lot of back burner projects on access technology. Some of the first projects at making very large scale or large screen braille displays. We developed the first compact text-to-speech system that could actually run in a microprocessor, and the touchscreen or touch-sensitive navigation for the audio and braille systems. One of the other projects that I had there, in fact, the first thing I did was I was hired on to look into security of magnetic stripe systems, and that included the BART, or Bay Area Rapid Transit, ticketing systems, and also the growing and up-and-coming magnetic stripes on the credit card systems. And so I was actually what they call nowadays a red team leader or a task force person that was called in to attack and hack the ATM systems, as well as also the early centralized voice systems. After about 5 years of that, I went on to work for Telesensory Systems for 5 years. And there I worked on a variety of different projects. The very first VersaBraille, for those of you who remember the VersaBraille, VersaBraille Classic. And my main contribution there was the serial interface. And I was also principal investigator on some other projects like a telebraille deafblind communication device, and that gave me a lot of experience on also other projects there at TSI, including augmentative communications aids for people that had various motor and vocal impairments and verbal impairments. And so I got quite a background there just working at TSI, but in the early 80s, I ended up starting up my own company, Personal Data Systems, and initially we built the Audaptor Speech Synthesizer, which a couple of you might have ever seen one, but they were one of the first fast response speech synthesizers. Previous to that, speech synthesizers would shut up halfway through the next sentence, maybe 2 or 3 seconds at least later. And so we did that and built up computerized systems around that, in particular scanning systems, We got into working with Arkenstone in its early days. I wrote a program called PicTac that made Arkenstone easier to use as a simple user interface. BuckScan, a dollar bill identifier. I said PicTac. I blew it. I'm sorry. EasyScan was the scanning program. PicTac was a graphics program. You could scan in pictures and get raised line drawings. And BuckScan was a dollar bill identifier. Over the years, my wife Deborah and I have worked on setting up and customizing computers. That's how I first met Paul, really, was setting up computers for Miami-Dade. We spent a lot of time, years and years, and developed over 500 customized computer systems with Braille and audio for folks, and got very, very involved in trying to make large print, Braille, and audio systems work with scanning, email, and all the other computerized uses. A little more recently, I spent some time helping startup Talking Solutions to develop an internet radio device that ended up, they bellied up due to lack of funds, often the cause. And they're also doing talking pill bottles and other products. But to ask or to answer the question that Paul had sort of asked me to answer, which is how I ever got involved in this, I was very interested in anything with an accessible interface. And so at conferences, when things would come up, like voting systems, where they were showing prototypes, this was 4 or 5 years ago, I was always on top of those to see what they were and try to throw out my 2 cents worth to the vendors' suggestions. And then about 4 years ago, Sam, who I think is on, and some of the rest of us here in Silicon Valley got to try out at a fair a bunch of different voting systems that they were considering here and give our input to what we thought they ought to improve. And about 3 years ago, we started trying to vote on these systems. And we were shocked to see that none of the things that we had suggested had been implemented, and that they were really just looking for our blessings when they showed them to us. And in fact, my first experience voting was trying to vote was on the Sequoia Edge 2s. These are what they call DREs. Some used to call touchscreens. Some still do, but formerly that was an appropriate term. It's no longer the right term. Touchscreen voting systems or electronic ballot systems. And we couldn't get the thing to work. The poll workers tried very hard, did their best, and struggled with it, calling tech support and all, for over 45 minutes and still couldn't get it working. So I had to give up and have someone else vote for me. Over the last several years, I've had 4 more voting experiences on the Sequoias. And out of those 5, in 3 of them, the poll workers were never able to get it working in audio mode by themselves. In one case, I luckily took along my very clever computer scientist wife, who, when after the poll workers gave up, she borrowed their manual, read the manual, and figured out how to boot it up, get it in audio mode and working so I could vote privately. I don't think all of you have wives like that, and we shouldn't have to have to be allowed to vote. And in the 4th election, I actually had to help them myself because they couldn't get it working. And I remembered from a voter access advisory committee that the chief technician for the Registrar of Voters office had said, "Oh, well, there's this hidden menu, and we need you to know about it and tell the poll workers about it. There's a hidden menu they have to bring up it just before they encode your card, your voter ID card, to say you're going to vote in audio." And they hadn't been doing that right. And I finally managed to get them to try it the way I had learned, and they got it working. So my concern on this was greatly amplified by the lack of success of the poll workers. Now, I should clarify very quickly, as Paul knows me and some of the others of you know, I love technology. I've got over a dozen working computers scattered throughout the house, and that's not counting all the dead ones. But I have a technology museum here, and I love technology. And I'm in no sense a Luddite who doesn't like technology. So when Havok came along, I was very excited about it and thought, boy, this will be great. We'll get good, clean voting without the hanging chad and overvotes like Florida had, and we'll get accessibility. That should be nice. what I found out was that the voting systems weren't good quality. They were actually shoddy, like junior high school science fair projects. The workmanship design was terrible. The accessibility was terrible, that many of the systems couldn't be used by anybody but some blind folks. And so I got involved in looking more into the security and found out that that was very bad, and as well as the accessibility for other folks, like people with low vision that needed simultaneous audio and visual. And about a year and a half ago, I got pulled in to the kinds of things that are not in my nature. I'm not an activist and never have been. I've always tried to do my part by just building and designing systems to help society. But I got pulled into some court cases as an expert witness and testified now, given affidavits for about six court cases around the country, and even asked to testify a week and a half ago in Washington for a hearing there. So I wrote up a report in February. It's entitled Improving Access to Voting Systems. And that is available on the web. We can tell you more about that. But that was my attempt to put all down in writing what I'd soaked up over the years about voting systems and their accessibility. And so that is at voteraction.org. It's also at demos.org, D-E-M-O-S.org. It's available in lots of different formats. It is in PDF, in DOC, in Braille, and in large print RTF. That ended up really spelling out what I understand the field to be. And then about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I wrote up a position letter that really stated in a summary way and asked people to sign on. We can talk more about that after I shut up.
So, at least to a degree, people might get the notion that Noel Runyon had bad experiences with a couple of DREs and therefore decided to essentially say a plague on both their houses. You know, there are lots of us, me included, who haven't had a lot of trouble with machines, took it upon ourselves to know how machines worked and to be able to school poll workers because, of course, I guess I certainly accept the fact that poll workers aren't very well trained. And I took the position right from square one that it probably wasn't appropriate for me to expect them to know how to do what I needed to get done, and so I needed to have some idea of how to do it. From my perspective, Noel, talk to me about why it is we should be concerned beyond the shoddiness. I accept the shoddiness as well. I also accept the absence of companies listening to the input of the people who have to use the systems. One of my pet peeves is, if you're going to vote in audio with virtually any of the systems, it takes an inordinately long time if there are a lot of races, not because it's an innately slow system, but because of the way the system's devised and because of the degree to which the user can't change the interface very easily, so that, in fact, he can speed up that whole process. But talk to me a little, if you would, about the other issues, because they're the ones that I think many blind people are having trouble with. For a lot of us, we would essentially say, wow, you know, we finally get to the place where we can vote privately and independently, and now all the bozos are saying that the systems are flawed, and then Noel Runyon, a guy we respect and a guy who we think is pretty good, starts writing these traitorous reports that essentially say that DRE machines can't be trusted. Help us to understand, Noel.
That may be easier said than done, Paul. It does get very complicated in several areas, but I'll stick to the main simple parts here because that's what we really need to understand anyway. And I should point out that if it was only me having a few bad experiences on one machine because I had a bad set of county clerk and poll workers, then I would have shut up. And originally I kept my mouth shut because I thought that might be the case at the very beginning. But I have gone to the NFB Center in Baltimore, and Steve Booth there was very gracious, letting me try out all the different machines they had there and giving me his opinions on them, as well as letting me really try them out and put them through their paces. And those were the various different leading machines that are usable around the country, such as the Ivotronic from ESNS that's used down in Florida a lot, where Paul is. And what I found is that these machines have been similarly poorly designed as far as their accessibility, and also sloppy. I hung the ESNS machine, and it wouldn't get out of a loop just because it was very bad design. These weren't just one particular style of machine, but all of these machines had been designed poorly. And their accessibility was originally, in many cases, not in their design plans when they built these machines. But the access was added on as a Band-Aid, or in some case tourniquets, after they already had their voting machines out there on the market. Some companies like Diebold actually made public statements that they thought that HAVA only meant that they had to make it accessible for the blind. And indeed, some of the companies, that's what they started out with, was making their machines accessible with speech for people who are blind, and ignoring almost all of the field's experience of screen review programs and other kinds of audio interfaces, just going out and doing their own thing. Some engineers thought they could slop things together and get them working. And they got very poor quality systems that were conceptually difficult, or cognitively difficult, as they say, for a lot of people to use. Slow because of that. And also just really not accessible for many, say, elderly people that have lost a lot of their eyesight late in life. They haven't been using speech for years like many of us. And to expect them suddenly to immerse themselves in a speech-only interface that's very complicated isn't reasonable. But most of these units did not even, when we started a couple of years ago here, they did not even have simultaneous audio and visual. Several of them, like the Ivotronics, still don't. So there are large groups of people that cannot use them. Yes, there are many of us. I've successfully voted several times now myself by eventually getting the machines working. And many of us can vote. But there are large groups of people who can't, who give up, leaving in tears because they couldn't manage to deal with the machine. And an example of other people that are included under HAVA would be the people, say, with severe motor impairments that need switched inputs. These are switches which they could sip and puff on, or have big, large jelly switches, as they call them, that they could push with a knee or an elbow or any body part that's mobile. And these systems just did not include those features. Slowly, sort of lawsuit by lawsuit and pressure by pressure, some of these companies have been adding those. These are basically the issues of bad accessibility, and because they're computerized systems, with enough time and pressure, many of those problems can be fixed. Some, because the machines are so slow and old machines using old Z80s or 486s, they can't have some of the newer access features. Some, evidently, their designs will actually block them from doing both audio and visual at the same time. So many of the machines cannot be fully upgraded to be accessible, but others can, and they promise they will be. So access itself isn't the long-range showstopper. When we're using a computer, there are many ways, as you know, we can get good access. We've had for over 15 years good accessibility on our regular computer systems, and without it being very expensive, using built-in audio, using screens that could magnify as well as show high contrast, we can do switched inputs and other kinds of motor adaptations. So that's not the real showstopper. Now, I mentioned earlier that the term touchscreen was no longer the right term to use. People used to refer to all of these voting machines as touchscreens. And what they're really talking about was electronic ballot systems. And this is an important distinction here in what we're talking about, we're leading into here in this. One is that you have paper ballots in some cases. The other is electronic ballots. So it's how the ballot is stored. That's very different from the user interface, how the user works with the machine. The user interface may be touchscreen, or in the case of like the e-slates, there's a screen, but you don't touch it. You just scroll with a wheel if you're sighted, or you use audio or and keyboards and switched inputs and things. So the interface is very different from what's becoming the big topic here, and that is how the ballot is stored. So what Paul and I are going to talk about here is some of the things that have come up on the ballot storage. Is that ballot stored just purely in electrons, in a memory card, or is it stored on paper? And the real access issue here is, do you have a way to confirm that your vote ever ended up there in a meaningful way? Let's say and grant that you have complete accessibility. Okay, let's say you have a wonderful interface, maybe even one that worked right in terms of speed and stuff, good audio. That the real problem still is, how do you really verify that your vote got there and was recorded? And what the public has found is that these machines are not allowing them to verify their votes, and the public is generally demanding paper-based ballot systems that they can look at and touch and see. Now we have to find a way, and we are finding ways, to get that same kind of verification for the rest of us.
The fact is that corruption in elections have kind of gone hand in hand forever and ever. Chicago is kind of notorious for going along with interesting elections. Florida in the year 2000 certainly had some major issues. And surely, if you go to an electronic machine, which is after all a computer, you're going to end up with a system that, for the most part, is going to be controlled in a computer and therefore beyond the reach of rigging for the most part. And if that's not the case, first, tell me why not. But second, far more important, give me evidence. I don't want to hear that you tell me that people could do something. I want you to tell me things that people actually did.
That is relevant. I mean, people sort of assume that if they had computers somehow that weren't hooked up over the internet, that would mean they're safer or something, can't be rigged. Everybody has stories they've heard about ballot stuffing, where you could stuff a whole bunch of ballots into a box that you voted on, which is actually not really the case anymore because they serialize the ballots and treat them almost like they're money. You can't just throw in a bunch of more paper ballots. But the problem is primarily that when the votes are rigged, that it's hard to tell because it's just an electronic memory card. These are a black box, as they call it, that you can't see inside of to see how it represented those votes. And that's what got computer securities experts and others very concerned, was there was not transparency to be able to look at these votes. And initially, a lot of people started getting panicky and saying, well, geez, these are computers that can have viruses just like other computers. And computer securities experts that knew about many different ways to beat on computers and hack them were getting very concerned about it. Well, at first, they were accused of just pie in the sky, dreaming, sitting back from an armchair and saying, well, you could do this and that would be bad, or you could do that. As they got more seriously into it, people started doing what's called threat models, where you actually look at the kinds of ways that you could threaten or hack a system. And what is the likelihood of that being done? What does it cost in terms of resources to do it? What are the benefits in terms of, like, how many votes can you really rig? And that's when they started getting even more concerned. Now, there were various scenarios laid out, and as people said, like Paul said, those bozos were throwing out all sorts of scenarios that they weren't sure would really happen or not. So what's happened over the last several years is they've started to find in real elections that the DRE systems were not only capable of being hacked, but they also could just plain flub up and make and mess up. In the case of New Mexico, in one county alone, there were over 12,000 votes lost in Bernalillo County, in a Democratic county, and that was in a state that went Republican for the president by only about 6,000 votes. So people started saying, well, wait a minute, this stuff can amount to real differences in election, and that's the key thing, is does some misrepresentation of your votes end up being significant enough to change the results of an election or the outcome? That's more important than was one vote lost. So they started saying that, yes, there are lots of screw-ups in Florida County. Paul can tell you about. They found of the people that signed in, 120% of them voted for George Bush, and only about 27% voted for Kerry. So only a total of 147% of the people managed to vote. And this was due to the fact that some poll worker kept ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk popping in their memory card into the tallying machine as if they didn't know what they were doing. Some people called that outright fraud. Others would say it was a poll worker accident. They started finding other mess-ups like that. And just the unreliability is actually what got New Mexico convinced that they should change their system. They didn't do it on the basis of all the possible hacks or riggings, but just on the fact that they had unreliable elections and that they were not as accessible as the machines should be. Now, some concrete examples. A lot of people have said computer scientists and others would have to write these programs. It would take very talented people. But I've got a couple of concrete examples I'll give you that don't require any talent, really, on your part. How to hack. There's actually a hacking the vote documentary that's out that has some of these things in there. But examples of some hacks. You know, what came out just before our election in November here was the same Sequoia machines that I ran into initial troubles with. They discovered just before the election that somebody finally admitted that there was a problem that as you cast your vote, the machine started to write it away in the memory. If you reached around back and punched the reset button, just before it got a chance to record that you were the voter number blah, 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 it would have recorded your vote and counted it, but not disqualified you as a voter because you reset it before it had a chance to do that. So people could actually keep pa-chunk, pa-chunk, pa-chunk voting away repeatedly on the machines. Now, their answer to this, you know, since it was at the last minute, was rather than fix it, was to have poll workers keep a good eye on the backs of the machines and make sure that monitors in polling places could watch. And, you know, hopefully there weren't too many cases where people would just have their buddy walk by to shield it. But that was something that did not require a hack in terms of a software, a mendacious or evil software program written. Another example of something like this that happened in Maryland, where one of the counties had a machine that had 54 people recorded as voting on one of these machines. It happens to be a D-Bolt, AccuVolt TS system, one of the machines with the worst track records for security. In the election, they found that 54 people voted on it, but the machine showed no votes recorded, or zero votes at the end of the day. And they said, well, how could this happen? We didn't have any error messages on the machine or anything. And they finally got Diebold to admit that there was a special security feature, as they called it, that in which if somebody pulled the memory card out at the beginning of the day or any time during the day and put it back in, the machine would react, supposedly for security reasons, by not recording any votes. However, it also did not tell anybody about it. You would think it would have put up on the screen, this machine void, you know, remove it from use, decommission this machine, it's been violated. It didn't put up any messages like that. It allowed voters to go ahead voting on it, and at the end of the day, the poll workers got their totals and weren't told that the machine had been in a special mode. Now, up to this point, I myself had left lots of room for just plain old incompetence on the part of the companies, for just not having a clue about good security. This was the first thing that I saw that I said, this is way beyond incompetence. This is not just criminal neglect. This is somebody purposely trying to come up with something that they can spread the word around the country, doesn't take any special virus memory card or anything like that, but a real simple to use mechanism by which you could wipe out the votes either all day long or maybe just in the evening. Maybe in the evening when, say, more Democrats vote. And I'm not going to tell anybody what party I belong to, but you could put a partisan bias in a system like that, either by knocking out certain precincts or knocking out a precinct at different times of day. Then we had some significant hack issues. As you may have heard of Hursti. This is a Finn who came in and did some work was brought in to test the systems in Florida. And Ian Sanchez down in Florida brought in Hursti, who actually was testing the optical scan machines there and found that they could even get viruses in there, that they could be, or that wasn't a virus, I'm sorry, they were tampered with. And they were tampered with a little pocket computer that cost $200, special pocket computer that farmers use, that allowed them to, in the voting booth, to pop a card from the machine into his little pocket computer, change the results on that card, and stick it back in the voting machine. Then Hursti went up to another state in the northwest here, and there found another hack, which was called Hursti 2, another way of getting into the system that was, any of you who are programmers would just cringe at this, but he found that they had left what's called a bootloader, which means a special program that's brought up when you boot up the machine holding the buttons down right or touching the menu right, and it brings it up in a special mode that overwrites all of the security. All of the security was overridden. It allows you to put in your run your own program by putting in your own memory card. So it actually ran off the memory card, loaded a special program. And you could load in a minute or two in a voting booth, a person could load a card. And he showed that that wasn't just a theoretical thing, but he was able to put in a real hack. More recently, and this is the last one I'll give for right now, and we can talk more about some of these later, but more recently, Princeton University's Ed Felton and his crew did work in which they actually designed what's called an imposter, or some people call them a Trojan horse program. This is essentially a virus program that can go any of the DRE voting machines or the summing machines. When I said DRE, we're talking about electronic ballot. That stands for direct recording electronic. But electronic ballot is what DRE means. He designed this virus to go in through the memory cards and be spread through the memory cards. He showed that he could write this program that could not be detected. The tamper wasn't detectable from the screens, and the poll workers wouldn't have a way of knowing it was in there, but yet it would be doing its dirty work on your votes. And he made up a videotape that showed actually doing a vote on one of these machines and having it change the names of the votes from George Washington to Benedict Arnold or vice versa. And then, furthermore, that program was able to spread from memory card to memory card. So even though it wasn't the internet, it was still possible for it to spread viruses. And this scared a lot of people because it showed a more significant problem here that computer scientists had been talking about, but an actual proof that you could have programs that could spread throughout the voting systems in a county or throughout the country. And that coupled with the fact that Hursti's hacks that showed problems that had been in, the problem had been in there for over 3 years since Maryland did their security test. It was in there at that time more than 3 years ago. So these were examples of not just armchair, somebody could do this, But I've given you a couple of examples of things that you could go out and do, or a party agent could go out and do. There are others, but these are some of the most real examples. And the way they've been coped with right now is by trying to change polling place procedures, to put lots of security tape all over the machines, which is a partial solution. It also introduces another exposure, is you could take machines out of work by just tampering with the security seals on them. That's called a denial of service attack that you probably all heard about on the internet, where your email gets slugged down because somebody is swamping the system. You can do denial of service attacks on voting machines. Those are very real. All you have to do is scratch the tamper tape or peel it up and then point out to a poll worker that, geez, this machine's been tampered with, and they're required to take it offline and not use it. So you can actually, a party agent or agents could take a bunch of machines out of play that way. But that's nowhere near as significant as the problem of problems spreading throughout machines, or problems that can be easily done by a lot of people throughout the country.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you're listening to Tuesday Topics. Once again, your host, Paul Edwards.
And I'm going to shove in a tiny 2 cents worth, and then we're going to get on to where we go from here. I got convinced long before hacks became demonstrated. And I was convinced when a number of people with whom I'd worked, who were actually pretty sympathetic towards accessible voting, pointed out to me that as concerned and as well-intentioned as they were about accessible voting, they couldn't sit by and look at election after election where individual precincts would demonstrate what are called undercounts. And essentially, these are when individuals obviously vote, but they don't vote in a particular race. And these undercounts were huge in some precincts here in Florida, and in fact in some precincts in Miami-Dade County. And it became clear that the statistical likelihood that those undercounts were the result of actions that were consciously taken by voters deciding not to vote in a given race were simply not likely. And one had to begin to consider the probability then that for some reason, whether it was human engineered or machine, didn't matter, the undercount wasn't being counted, and it was deliberately not being counted, and people were being disenfranchised. And I think there are a lot of us who would probably argue that given the closeness of the election in 2000, given the closeness of the election in 2004, the chances are that a lot of races would have turned out differently, and perhaps even presidential election, had we been dealing with machines that appropriately counted. And obviously, just before somebody else jumps up and says it, there are lots of other ways you can intimidate voters, and there are many of those being tried in Florida. There are ways of discouraging black voters. There are ways of discouraging women voters. There are ways of creating environments where voting is extremely uncomfortable that don't have a damn thing to do with machines. But it certainly is important, once people have had the guts to vote, for them to be able to vote with machines that actually, A, are likely to record their vote, and B, where they can be sure that their vote's recorded and that it actually gets counted. And that, Mr. Runyon, is the question. How do we do that? If DREs don't work, if direct recording electronic voting machines won't work, what will? How do we use them? And then, how do we build accessibility in?
Good question. And this whole business started pretty much maybe a decade ago or so with voting machine manufacturers that had previously just been ballot printing companies and in some cases supplied some of the optical scanners for those ballot systems. But they got involved in trying to come up with a solution of storing the records or your votes, your ballot, electronically in the machines, and said, boy, this is clean. that we'll be able to move these nice clean votes, copy them, move them through the system on computers. And that seemed like a very good solution. And as I say, when HAVA first came out, it seemed to me like it was going to be a good clean solution. But what they found was that the basic approach, the basic architecture of it, was fundamentally flawed. The fundamental flaw was there was no way to really verify that your vote was recorded the way you intended it to, the way the voter wanted their vote. And they refer to this in general now as software independent verification. The National Institute of Standards and Testing, NIST, came up with the paper that really helped convince a lot of people that were sort of on the fence about this. They said, hey, you really have to have a way to have software independent verification. And what this means is, in any of the technologies we have working today, that you need paper so that a voter can look at that paper. This is, we'll start with sighted voters, can look at that paper and see that that was what their vote was. They can say, okay, the machine might record it electronically and they might count it electronically, but I want to see it on paper. And this is something that's difficult for some blind folks to really understand, how and why sighted people feel that paper is so solid and tangible and reliable. Once it's on paper, it's just like many of us felt about paper Braille. When we started working with the first Versa Brailles and things, I would take my notes in paper Braille and give talks on paper Braille cards because I didn't trust the darn Versa Braille that I was expected to help people to use if it came to something important like a talk. But what has happened is that they found that the only way currently that we have that works is to have paper. And so a lot of computer scientists and other people started saying, well, we have to have a paper record involved. Now, a lot of the disability advocates are concerned, saying, well, but this isn't accessible. People with handicaps, handicaps is probably a politically incorrect term. They may have said that, but people with disabilities really need to be able to have access to this ballot system. If you hand them paper ballots, blind folks aren't going to be able to generally to mark those by themselves. We need access. And at the time, there weren't accessible solutions that worked with that paper. And because of that, many groups got very vociferous about this and really got excited about fighting paper and digging in their heels and saying, no, you can't use paper. We want to insist on our electronic ballot systems because they're more accessible. Well, times have changed. Because what they found is that they could design voting systems that would allow you to sit at a computer interface and use speech, large print, switched inputs, keypad inputs, touch screens, or whatever you wanted, and to give the system your message of what you wanted as your vote, and then have it to mark a ballot for you. That's a paper ballot. So that you could actually get the same kind of paper ballot marked that the rest of the population was using. This was important for a couple of reasons. One is to keep from getting segregated ballot systems, which is what some counties are using now, where they'll have the accessible computer systems are voting electronically, storing the ballots electronically, and you have a segregated system that's separate from what the sighted people are using, where they're using absentee ballots in paper, and they're using optically scanned paper ballots also in the polling place. So this was not very acceptable, and there are a couple of different ballot marking devices, as they're called, or BMDs, now in the market. There's several, and companies are coming up with new versions of these. Some of them are more accessible than others. Most of them have better accessibility than the DREs, or at least as good. And we're talking about two separate things here. The way you store the ballot, that's electronic or paper, and the way you access it. There is no reason, really, that the access needs to be any different, with one exception we'll come back to. But as far as in general, you can have a computer interface whether it's going to end up marking a paper ballot or an electronic ballot. And that computer interface can be just as accessible with speech, large print, and switched input for people that are severe impairments, motor impairments, etc. So it doesn't have to be a poor quality interface or less accessibility for us just because it's paper. In fact, it's more likely to be better because the companies that are designing these ballot marking systems are starting from scratch, knowing from the beginning that they have to have accessibility for all folks, and building that in so you're not ending up with Band-Aids piled on Band-Aids piled and tourniquets piled on top of those. But they're building it in from the beginning. Now, there's still some rubs with these. The ballot marking devices that are out there are not perfect. They have some weaknesses, and that some people would say that they're at least as good as the DREs. Other people would say if they're not going to be perfectly designed, then we don't want them. And Paul and I will discuss more for you some of the things that are going on politically, such as a Holt bill in Congress that's trying to force the issue here to say, by the 2008 election, there won't be any voting on the electronic ballot systems. A lot of people think the time frame for that is just totally unrealistic. I feel that that's generally the case, too. But the issue that's really at hand, what's really getting people riled up is, do we take these flawed electronic systems that are somewhat accessible for, and sometimes enough for some people to do fine on, do we take those and chuck them all out? Or do we find a way to, say, put a printer on them and make them more secure, where they will print a ballot out? Maybe we're just modifying this machine and turning it into a ballot marking device, but so that this what used to be an electronic ballot machine could be a paper ballot printing machine. That's an approach that's being used, and it has some mixed results. New York folks, any of you in New York may know that ACB in New York is considering suing because they're faced with a very poor approach to that in the Avanti system. And I'll bring this up as an example. It prints a paper ballot, but it's not a ballot that you're allowed to scan back into the system to say, wait a minute, did you mark that right? You don't have anything that indicates what actually made it on the paper. Now, the company will argue, well, we know what was sent to the printer. We can tell you and not lie about that if you trust us. But trust what we sent to the printer. How am I going to trust that the printer wasn't out of ink? And also, it's a flawed system in that it only produces a text printed ballot, not an optically scanned ballot. So it's a different kind of print ballot. And again, a segregated ballot system. Those ballots are set aside and counted later, maybe. We're not sure. We shouldn't have to be in that position not being sure if our ballots were counted on election night or not. What we're ending up with is, in some cases, kludges, in other cases, systems that work pretty well. But the ballot marking systems are right now they're pretty young, and the field is young. They're coming up with new systems and improving them rapidly. Some of the systems work much better than others, but because of legislation in Congress, they're talking about trying to force solutions and force counties to rush out and use new systems, or for manufacturers to develop overnight new kinds of systems. And I do have a proposal. If we have time here, I'll mention it for what a really good ballot marking system can be, because I'm confident that it doesn't seem to, these systems don't have to have any inherent flaws in them, but they need to be better than most of the systems we have today. And sort of in summary of this, what we're finding is that a lot of folks have been fighting very hard to try to improve the accessibility, and a lot have been fighting the paper versus electronic ballot issue and trying to prevent paper from being used. And that's a war that we've lost. It's not just we're losing it, we've lost it. The public is voting on their own by saying, I'm going to vote with absentee ballots. I'm going to vote with paper even if the polling machines in the polling place are not paper. They're starting to convert over in droves because of their crisis in confidence in the reliability of the voting systems. So we've lost that, and we can't go back to the electronic ballot systems because of their flaws. So we need, as a disabilities community, to get on board to try to put our energies and our focus towards making sure that these paper ballot systems that we're going to be dealing with are accessible and fully accessible. Paul doesn't like that term, and I don't like it either. Some people throw it out. I like to refer to it as broadly accessible for a broad spectrum of different disabilities and combinations of disabilities. We need to work to make sure these paper systems are going to work right, put our energies behind that instead of trying to block the coming use of paper ballot systems.
Noel, what I'm going to propose that we do now is, I don't think we're done, and what I'd like to propose, we continue talking and then give Steve the joy of turning this into 2 one-hour shows, because I think we probably still have enough to discuss, if you're prepared to stick around for that length of time, for us to talk about really where we go from here. If you're good with that.
I'm here for whatever time you need me. I really have a problem of not knowing how to say no. This is why I got sucked into this, because as an engineer, this is not my kind of stuff. The news conferences I've had to be in, the testifying in trial, scary stuff to me. But been willing to do it because as a citizen, we really need more information out there. So I'm delighted to do what I can to help spread information. A couple of quick housekeeping things. Wanted to point out the people that do want to get on board with signing a letter demanding that we have secure and accessible voting systems and have an end to systems that are not, that they can email to an email address I'll give you in 1 second, and just ask to be put on that list. If you do, please give your name and any title or affiliations you want. Titles and affiliations are not required. And you should be careful that you're not speaking for an organization that's going to come beat you up later for speaking for the whole organization. But just if you want just your name, that's fine. I'll be able to send you in whatever media format you want. If you want these, the letter is also at the voteraction.org site. And that's also where you can find copies of my Improving Access to Voting report if you want to get more detail in terms of really getting under the hood of all the technical details of voting, accessible voting system. You could download even the RTF if you want. The RTF is the large print version. I put the word up there as the full thing. The Braille is the summary, just the executive summary. It is close to what was put in the CCB newsletter. The CCB newsletter has a under 200 lines limit, and we trimmed it down even further for that. I have the complete Braille format of the report if you really want it. I figured most people wouldn't really want to be running it because it got into so many pages. I think what we have there was reasonable amount of Braille to run out, but just contact me. You could do it through that voting@skyhighway.org.
Thanks, Noel. What we're going to do now, ladies and gentlemen, is we're actually going to come to the end of our first hour's program. We hope that all of you who've listened this evening will come back next week and hear the end of this story. The issues that we've discussed on this evening's program, it seems to me, are vital for blind people and any citizens interested in developing a fair and appropriate election system. Next week, what we would like to do is to spend some time talking about the actual solutions that are there. We'll come up to speed from where we were very quickly, actually, and then go on to try to describe what it is we need to do now. Because after all, that's the question. The first hour will be on demand, Thomas, who just left me a text message, starting on ACB Radio next week on Tuesday, and then a week after that, the second program should be up there. If you want to eventually do folks a favor, you can and have the expertise, you can volunteer to help put together an archive, because at the moment there are probably close to 100 of these programs floating around somewhere, but have never been put in a single archived location. So we would eventually like to do that. Noel, thanks very much for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an issue that is not going to go away. I believe that by 2008, there will be many constituencies where voting will be handled very differently from the way it was in 2004, whether disabled individuals will be more fully enfranchised or more completely disenfranchised remains to be seen. And it's very much up to us to determine which of those two things happens. Noel Runyon, thank you very much for being here. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to these 2 hours on voting access, and thank you for tuning in to Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.